Support for The Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette Mail with its two editorial pages, one liberal, one conservative, kind of like The Front Porch. Find out how to subscribe at wvgazettemail.com. And you're on The Front Porch, where we tackle the toughest issues facing Appalachia in the same way you talk with your friends on The Front Porch. This week, we have a battle royale between two of West Virginia's best policy wonks, Ted Bettner, head of the liberal-leaning West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Hey, Ted.
Hey, how are you doing, Scott?
And Garrett Ballingy. He's the leader of the Cardinal Institute, a right-leaning West Virginia think tank. Hey, Garrett.
Thanks for having me here, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. Garrett and Ted are going to debate how West Virginia can become a more prosperous state, and yes, it can happen. Lori Lynn is with us, as always, the lawyer, conservative columnist who tweets at WV Pundit. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And Rick Wilson is away, sadly. There'll be no Bible verse this week. He's having a colonoscopy. I'm not making that up. He's actually having one. I can't think of a single funny thing to say about that.
Oh.
Ted? Ted's holding himself back.
We'll Ted. Get the full report next week.
All right. So my first question, I guess, is, Ted, what is Garrett Ballingy's best argument? What is the argument that you hear the Cardinal Institute say that you're like, yeah, you know, they got a point?
Yeah, I think there are several, but I think the strongest argument that the Cardinal Institute and other conservatives have is that there's a lot of things in the public sector that need to be a lot more efficient, and that we need a better bang for the buck. And I think conservatives in particular do a really good job of finding those inefficiencies and alerting liberals like me. I might have my blinders on to some things like RESAs. We can go through them. But there are some things I think that we need to work on. And just because a government agency is there or a program doesn't mean it needs to always be there. And I think conservatives do a really good job of pointing that out to liberals who unfortunately sometimes don't see those things. So I always think that's a really good argument.
Same question to you, Garrett. What's the argument that Ted makes that you find yourself agreeing with?
Well, I think this may surprise some folks, but I tend to find myself agreeing with some of their thoughts on their tax policy. For example, transparency, tax credits. Where are we giving tax credits? To whom are they giving? Are they meeting sort of the job creation promises that they often make? What kind of deductions are we giving to businesses and industries in the state? You know, they tend to make the argument this is an inefficient way to collect revenue. This is an inefficient way to incentivize growth. And I think a lot of people on the right or more on the libertarian side tend to agree with those types of arguments as well. So we do have some agreement on the tax policy.
So, Ted, let me just follow up on that. Where do you maybe see some inefficiencies? Where could we cut the state budget? Don't say justice reform, because you want to do that anyway.
Yeah, that's, juvenile
but,
justice,
but
corrections.
Some, right, but something that you actually think government is a good thing that government does, where would you be willing to see us do less of it or spend less money on it?
I think up front there are investments that we can make that we can save a lot of money down the road, like early childhood education.
No. That's spending. I'm talking about
I'm just saying
less
long-term.
Spending.
Well, that's less spending over the long run.
But without answering it in terms of investments, so yeah, where we just less flat out less spending.
I think it's sort of an arbitrary question in the sense that I don't know exactly what spending you
answer
refer
the
to.
Question, Bettner. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I'll try to answer. Okay, there are several things I think we can look at. The Department of Education, I think a couple of things that have been brought up there about bureaucracy. RESAs in particular are something I don't know if we need going forward. I'd like to know more information about it, but I think there are things in the Department of Education, especially in the administration head, that conservatives and Democrats and Republicans have talked about that could be reduced. That'd be a good example.
And Garrett, to you, what's a tax that you could live with being a little bit higher?
Why doesn't he get the spending question? What does he want to spend money on?
Well, I think that our more immediate problem is revenue. So
yeah, I think purely from an efficiency of tax code type of question, I think generally speaking, property taxes are seen as, if you tend to raise a property tax, they're less harmful to economic growth over the long run. And that's sort of contra corporate income tax or personal income taxes, which most people seem to believe are more harmful to economic growth over the long run. And in a situation that West Virginia finds itself, I think property taxes and to some extent consumption taxes are things that we should probably look at. Again, I'm not sure I'd be happy if that happened, but I think from purely an efficiency of the tax code standpoint, I could live with that.
What do you think about the sweetened beverage tax?
I think we're sort of repeating some of the mistakes that we've made as far as depending on volatile sources of revenue to fund the government services. And, you know, most of the things that I've seen bandied about as far as a tax on like a 12-ounce can of soda or something like that, I mean, if it's a public health benefit, it has the same amount of glucose, for example, as two pieces of white bread. And so if we're looking at this from a public health benefit standpoint, I'm not sure the sugary tax is probably the way to go.
mean, the one argument I would make to that is that bread has other things other than glucose. It also has fiber, other things, where a soda is pure, mostly high fructose corn syrup. And also, I think we should, you know, look at our taxes on things that have huge externalities, like pollution, things that are making us unhealthy. So like tobacco, soda is definitely one of those. And so when things have external costs that we all have to pay in higher insurance premiums or higher Medicaid payments, I think that's a fair game to look at those things, because those are a market inefficiency because they have external costs that they're not absorbing.
So I want to back up and do a question that's really more about the big picture. It seems like there's a chicken and egg issue. Do you invest, say, in West Virginia's health and education first, and that leads to prosperity, which leads to taxes, which pay for other things that we want? Or do you cut taxes and improve the regulatory climate first, which leads to more taxes, which pays for education and health and all those sorts of things? So, Garrett, how would you answer that chicken and egg question?
To me, it all comes down to what are you able to produce? You can't consume things unless you can produce things. And so I would look at cutting back taxes that interfere or distort with the production process, taxes on capital, taxes on income, right? Things that limit folks' ability to produce goods and services for their fellow people, things that we commonly describe that as economic growth. And I think if we do that, I think a lot of these other things that we're talking about, you know, West Virginia's poor health statistics, things like that, I think you would see these things start to improve. I mean, let's face it, healthy food is expensive, running shoes, gym memberships, all these things cost money. And people have money when they have a job, and you create a job whenever you make it easier for folks to start and run a business.
Ted, same question.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we're going to strongly disagree. I mean, I think when you look at the academic research on tax levels and economic growth, most research, especially since 2000, shows that it doesn't have much of an impact. And we know that tax cuts do not pay for themselves. When we look at businesses, they're a very small share of the cost of doing business, 2%. We've done this before. We've given over $250 million annually in business tax cuts, and where has it got us? We have fewer private sector jobs today than we did in 2006. We can look at other states as well. And I just think it's very important. Businesses grow because they have customers. That means increasing income and wages of working families in the state. And I think that is where prosperity comes from. And if you want to address health problems, address them. You're not going to be able to address them by cutting broad-based sales taxes or income taxes. And it's also very important to understand, too, when you're looking at, you know, going from a income tax to more of a consumption tax, that's a complete redistribution of wealth. So you're taxing high-income people less and middle-income people more.
I would say on the question of research, I think it just depends on what you look at. I mean, the Tax Foundation did a literature review of 26 studies going back to 1983. All but three of those studies showed a negative effect on income growth whenever you increase certain taxes, the worst being corporate income followed by personal income tax. What I always tend to see in these types of debates, one side has their stats, the other side has their stats. So I think it's a matter of getting down to the principles of it and saying, what do we think is going to create widely shared prosperity and economic growth? I would say, let's divest that. Let's let individuals run their lives the best way they think they know how. Let's allow them to better their own situation. And in a market economy, that means creating goods and services that folks value.
I would just say, I mean, when you're looking at taxes, I mean, we looked at 38 studies from 2004, and a lot of the studies that the Tax Foundation promotes, like one by Robert Reed, got completely debunked by William Gale at the Brookings Institute. But it just follows some logic. If you give rich people more money, they save it. They don't invest it. And that's why top-down tax cuts don't work. But if you do an EITC, if you give low-income people money, it goes right into the economy. And to me, that's the real difference. So you don't need to look at the studies. Just look at the logic. And it's just, you know, people... And taxes are important, don't get me wrong, but they're just not a high cost share of doing business.
Isn't there some truth to the fact that if your taxes and regulatory climate are out of whack with your competitors, that it'll have some effect? I mean, obviously, at some point, the taxes or the regulations become so burdensome, and businesses, many of them do have the ability to move. At what point does that become too much?
Well, look at the cost to move a business, especially a bigger business. That's an enormous amount of cost. And to do that, like I said, over less than 2% of your cost of doing business doesn't seem to me like the profitable thing to do. Businesses move where there are customers, where there's access to markets, where there's a skilled workforce. How do you get a skilled workforce? You got to invest in it. So I think that's the big difference. And also, when you're looking at regulatory environment or big tax changes, you know, the legislature wanted to expand the sales tax to all professional services. There are two states that do that at a very low rate. Basically, New Mexico and Hawaii. That doesn't make us competitive. It makes us huge outliers.
Yeah, sure. It's expensive to move businesses. I mean, there's certainly no doubt about that. But I mean, there was a reason why the whole tax inversion controversy came up within the last couple of years. You had huge corporations, Fortune 500 companies moving all across the world. To them, it doesn't seem that expensive when compared to the type of tax rates and things that they face in the United States. I think they understand what the costs are quite well. And it seems to me that their analysis is saying, well, we would rather take the burden of moving our operations overseas than to face the type of income tax rate or the regulatory environment that most businesses are facing in the United States.
And this is where I think we kind of agree to, like, the corporate income taxes, I think, is fraud with loopholes. And there's a whole gaming business. I always say, if you're paying the corporate income tax unless you don't have a very good accountant, because most businesses don't pay it, probably way more than 50%. So I would definitely look at, like, I think the federal corporate tax reform actually has a good effort being made at looking at corporate tax reform and bringing that money back. So I think we agree on that.
Ted, you talk about taxes not really affecting people's decision making.
Having a large impact.
Your center wants to hike the personal income tax top marginal rate up by quite a bit. I think it's income over $200,000. I mean, what do you think someone, say a county official in one of the Eastern Panhandle counties, is going to think about that? I mean, those counties have grown quite a bit, and they're, you know, one of our few economic bright spots in the state. People with pretty high incomes from, you know, who maybe work in the D.C. area, move from Virginia or Maryland into the Panhandle. I mean, we'd be telling those people, come to West Virginia for the bad schools, stay for the personal income tax hike. I mean, does that really make sense, especially in a place like that?
I think when we're looking at comprehensive tax reform, we can't just let the poor pay and the middle class pay for all of it. I think you have to have a balanced approach. And that's why we looked at that. And if you look at people moving across state lines, there's been lots of studies on the estate tax that show that that doesn't happen. Those are sort of like your anecdotal evidence that, oh, someone's going to move because of this. It takes a lot for someone to move. And people also value what's in their community as well.
Well, it's not only someone moving. It's sometimes it's, you know, I'm moving to the D.C. area. Where am I going to be?
You'll pay
in
higher
the DC
taxes
area.
There.
Well,
you move
sure,
to D.C.
But I mean, you have whole counties in Virginia to choose from. You have counties in Maryland. I'm just saying, I mean, it's not always a question of, you know, I live in Virginia. Am I going to move to West Virginia? No, I'm not. I mean, you're talking about, same with businesses. If a business wants to locate in the, you know, Mid-Atlantic region, they have a bunch of options. Why would we want to make ourselves a less attractive option?
Well, I think we are a less attractive option because we have the least share of people in this state without a college degree. And I don't think anybody is a tax reductionist. I just look at taxes to make every decision when they're such a small factor, especially for a business. They look at a whole host of factors that are considered. Look, electricity costs, the difference between property taxes. You talked about that. Go to Montgomery County, Maryland. Pay 3 or 4 times as much as in property taxes. Go ahead. Go to New Jersey. You're going to pay more. Go to Florida. They don't have an income tax, but they sure have a huge property tax. And when I talk a lot of people who make West Virginia sort of a bedroom community, you do hear like, hey, we have really low property taxes here.
So I have a question based on all this for Garrett. You know, you could make us the most attractive tax and regulatory climate in the entire country. And yet, if we are an uneducated, unhealthy, drug-ridden hellhole, I don't think you're going to get a lot of businesses to move here. So how can you do both of those at the same time? How can you address our really significant education and health challenges while also, you know, making sure we're competitive in a tax and regulatory way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think from an education perspective, we have to allow people to have the ability to choose their education. You know, that's something that Cardinal Institute, for example, is really big believers in, is the fundamentally education choice. So if you're a poor person who's stuck in rural Logan County or something like that, and you don't have a choice of what kind of education your child could get because you don't have the income to send them to a better school or pay for an online curriculum or to hire a private tutor, to me, that's a very big issue. And I think something like education choice or school choice allows families that are stuck in those situations to finally have an option and to give their kids the same type of opportunities that families in South Hills, Charleston are able to give theirs. And so I think options, competition in our education system would be one way to affect that. And I think, frankly, I think the addiction crisis and things like that, I think these are all symptoms of people not having a purpose. And I think one of the big ways that you can give someone a purpose in life is to give them a job. And I think, again, one way that you do that is having a competitive tax and regulatory environment.
That's Garrett Ballingy. He is the head of the Cardinal Institute here in West Virginia. We're also joined by Ted Bentner, West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Coming back in just a minute with our Battle Royale on the Path to Prosperity in West Virginia. But first, you're listening to West Virginia Public Broadcasting right now and The Front Porch because 10,000 people become members of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And I've got a really good reason to become a member right now, something really special. It's Hall's Chocolate, H-O-L-L-S. For anyone who's in West Virginia, they know all about it. We're in the middle of our chocolate challenge right now. You can get a box of chocolates delivered anywhere in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day, for your sweetie. It's an easy way. You can even tell them that you did this to support West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and they get the chocolate too. So go to wvpublic.org, check that out right now. Help us get some chocolates. Everybody's happy. Thanks. You're on The Front Porch with Scott Finn and Lori Lynn, and this week we are geeking out about how to improve the state's economy with two of West Virginia's best policy wonks, Ted Bentner, head of the liberal-leaning West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Garrett Ballingy, leader of the Cardinal Institute, a right-leaning West Virginia think tank. So we were just talking before the break about health, education, and dealing with some of those big issues with charter schools. When I was a journalist in Florida, we did a lot of coverage of charter schools. My understanding is the studies say that overall in Florida, they weren't better or worse than the public schools in helping to improve the educational outcomes, but it really depended on the school. You know, how was it done? How was it managed? How was it operated? What does the Cardinal Institute say about how charter schools should be managed so that they're a successful part of improving education?
Yeah, I mean, I think charter schools are one component of this puzzle, one piece of this pie. You know, we're in favor broadly of education choice, things like vouchers, education savings accounts. But the thing about charter schools that I think differentiates them in a positive way from public schools, they're accountable to parents. And so if they're not performing, I guarantee you the first people to know that are their very own parents. And the benefit of having a charter school type of system is they can be closed down if they're not performing. It's very difficult to do that in an underperforming public school. And again, because parents have the option to take their kid out of that school and no longer give their money, just like any other sort of business or any other industry or economy, if they're not performing up to expectations, they don't get the parents' business.
I want to ask Ted just sort of a big picture question on education. I mean, what's your vision for how we can spend money on education that actually has a positive impact in the state versus, you know, I mean, you can educate someone K through 12, great. They go off to college in another state, they stay in that other state, or even they go to WVU and go away to another. I mean, the decision to actually have educated people locate and stay here is kind of separate from the education that they get here. They need to have a job. They need to have a community that they want to live in. So how does that all kind of link together in your mind with education spending?
At the higher education level, I mean, a good example we always give is if you take the corporate income tax cuts and the business franchise tax cut, if you use that money instead, you could provide tuition-free two-year and four-year at all public colleges in West Virginia. I can't think of anything more attractive to for families to move here if they knew that they could send their kids to college tuition free. And those are choices. That was a choice we made between giving $250 million to businesses versus investing in families and in our middle class.
But again, it's awesome if they come here and get a free and great, you know, public college education. But then if they all just go away to Maryland and Virginia,
you know,
then how does that actually help us as a state versus helping the education system, which, you know, is a different thing and a good thing maybe. But
no, I totally agree with you. We want to attract as many people here as we possibly can. We want to actually import people too, not just people who grew up here like yourself. We want more people to come into our state. And like I said, the best thing you can do for economic development is improve the quality of life in West Virginia. And one huge quality of life issue is having a really good world-class education system. If we were the only state in the country that had tuition-free higher education, that would be a huge incentive, huge, to make people move here and to raise their families.
I got way in here because this has been something that the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities has talked a lot about. It's the choice we've made, and Democratic governors and legislatures made too, by the way, about cutting business taxes over the last few years. And the question was, okay, shouldn't we see prosperity by now? So I'll raise that with Garrett. I imagine those are sorts of changes that the Cardinal Institute would be in favor of and even doing more of. At what point would you expect to be able to show the impact of those And how long should we wait before we say, you know, that's really not working, or that, or maybe you would say we need to give it more time?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say, generally speaking, it takes about 3 to 5 years to see growth kick in from tax decreases. There's a reason for that. I mean, people plan, investment takes time, hiring takes time, balancing sort of your cost and things like that. All that sort of stuff takes time, and it takes planning. And so generally speaking, I would say 3 to 5 years is a good time to wait on that. But that's really a ballpark type of guess. But I would say we've done the other way for about 80 years. And so I think this stuff is going to take some time. You know, we're not promising any sort of economic miracles or anything like that. We're just saying, let's give an alternative view a chance, and let's just see how it goes.
Was the Democrats that instituted those tax cuts, though?
Well, you're making a political argument there that it didn't really help them.
The 80 years. I'm like, well, it was Democrats that did the tax cuts. And that was about a decade ago. And we have fewer private sector jobs today than we did before the tax cuts. But we've improved our tax foundation climate ranking. You know, we were 37th, now we're 18th, so that's great.
No, I mean, this stuff doesn't operate in a vacuum, right? So you have certain regulatory factors, you have certain globalization type of issues going on. I mean, there are a number of different factors, and to take tax policy, right, in a vacuum, I think is probably short-sighted, and I think most folks on either side of the aisle would agree with that.
I also think it's really hard, you know, the collapse of the coal industry really confounds our ability to look at any given tax change and say, you know, this helped or it didn't. I mean, when you have the state's biggest industry really, you know, cratering, whole communities are going to be hurt by that. And it's really hard to look and say, well, tax didn't help at all.
Well, I think when you look at the tax cut, $250 million, roughly, that's about $6,000 per business establishment in West Virginia on average. So if I go up to a business here in downtown Charleston, say, here's $6,000, what are you going to do with that? They might buy some capital equipment, maybe. Are they going to hire somebody? No. I mean, they can't hire somebody with $6,000, and that's the average across all businesses. So just follow some logic that it's not going to have a huge impact. And most of the businesses that pay it are out of state, so you have a huge exportability issues, especially with the severance tax. When you're lowering that, you're just giving a huge tax break to out-of-state businesses.
The argument that makes most sense to me, and I'll admit I don't have studies and facts to back this up, but it's the one that appeals to my gut, is the issue of equity with other states and surrounding states. And I think there are psychological factors that go into play too. If we were to raise our business taxes back up to where they were 5 or 10 years ago, it would be a hugely bad story for trying to bring business to the state. And I think it would change people's attitudes toward maybe we shouldn't have made those decisions, or maybe we should. But, we're spending a lot of energy on this issue. Is that because you're worried, Ted, that they're going to go in and cut more business taxes? And you're like, this hasn't worked, so let's not continue to do it.
I mean, we can just look at other experiments in other states like Kansas. Look, they've cut massive taxes and for passive businesses, and it hasn't really helped out there. I think you have to understand too, like back to that original question, businesses want a lot of things. If you look at the number one thing businesses want from Area Development Magazine, they want a well-skilled, well-trained workforce. Well, how do you do that? You have to pay for that. You have to invest in K-12 education. You have to invest in higher education. You have to invest in workforce training. And you can't get something for free. You know, and I think pushing that tax responsibility on to middle-class people whose incomes have basically been stagnant for 35 years, while profits have gone up dramatically over that time, I think that's very inequitable. And I think businesses look at a lot more than taxes. And I think if they say, hey, we have really good skilled workforce here, we have a really good public assets, a good quality of life, that's what attracts people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Kansas story is interesting, although I don't think it's been written on that quite yet. I mean, if you look, for example, every year since the tax cuts were instituted, new business formations have broken records. Kansas offers a really interesting case study because you have half the city basically on Missouri and the other half in Kansas, and you look, the unemployment rate has dropped more precipitously on the Kansas side. Granted, their revenues losses were more extreme than they predicted.
They've been downgraded twice, their credit rating.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, and again, it's because of what you mentioned. I mean, they had some poorly written tax policy. They issued an exemption for pass-through entities that basically exempted folks from any kind of income tax if they were a partnership, an LLC, sole proprietorship. And I don't think anybody on either side of the aisle would recommend that as good tax policy. Or you could look at the North Carolina experiment. North Carolina has also cut taxes, and they're experiencing record growth.
That's about average with U.S. growth, but...
Well, compared to where they were, I mean, certainly a much better situation to be in. They're running a revenue surplus. So these things can go either way. It just depends, to be honest. And it's what side you think offers your state the greatest probability of succeeding.
West Virginia is a very unique place, as we all know. And we love it.
Center of the universe.
Yeah, only for West Virginians, but yeah. It's a beautiful place. It's a place where people are very low income. Let's talk about our competitive advantage. In a nutshell, it either is or could be West Virginia's competitive advantage over other places in America and even in the world? Start with you, Ted.
I think we have a low cost of living, and I think especially in some parts of the states, especially the eastern side and the panhandle, you have an area that has wonderful, beautiful public assets that we've put together, like parks, like the New River Gorge. I think building upon that, recreation and tourism is a very untapped resource in West Virginia. We haven't even begun to really explore. But, you know, that's going to take other investments like in broadband and things to really attract people. But I think that quality of life, that small town, and I think, you know, other than other states, I think West Virginians talk to each other a little bit more. I'll never forget being like going to school in New Hampshire and saying hello to somebody in the elevator. And they're like, what are you doing? You know, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm from West Virginia. But I think it's a very attractive asset.
Yeah, I think this is one area he and I will agree. I think the low cost of living is certainly an advantage. I would also say, and this is definitely harder to quantify, but there's a peculiar factor with West Virginia, right, that I think attracts a lot of people. Like, this is sort of one of the last undiscovered type of places. And it's my hope that type of interest on the part of folks will attract certain types of people to the state and say, you know what, this state's never really had a good, but maybe I can make a little bit of a difference and I can save a little money when I do it. And I can feel good about making a change in a state that's been long derided as an economic backwater. So I think trying to harness that peculiar factor and teasing out what it is when you say, you know, West Virginians are unique, and using that to try to attract people, I think is a good idea and an advantage for us.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I think the fact that it is unique and yet very close to big population centers on the East Coast, I mean, you know, you can get quirky, you can get unusual, you can get really beautiful outside experiences, and you don't have to go to Montana to do it. And to me, that's kind of the selling point.
All right. Anything else that you wanted to make sure got said? Do you want to have a quote-unquote closing statement, Ted?
No, I mean, I would just say, you know, in closing, like, if we want to make West Virginia the best place to live, work, and raise a family, we're going to have to make investments in our K-12 system, our higher education system, and infrastructure like broadband. These things will help improve our state's economy and help grow the middle class.
Garrett, closing statement.
I would say I think West Virginia, if it's to improve its lot in life, you have to remove all the hurdles and all the barriers that get in the way of people trying to improve their own lives. And in a free economy, that's best served by serving your fellow man. So I think any structures or barriers that we can remove, whether it's in tax policy or regulatory barriers, would serve us well now and certainly in the future.
That's Garrett Ballingy. He is with the Cardinal Institute here in West Virginia. And you've also been hearing from Ted Bettner with West Virginia Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you guys both for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
I hope we can do this again, maybe during the legislature today, which is our TV show, or some other opportunities.
Great.
I'm here with Lori Lynn. I'm Scott Finn. Rick Wilson, unfortunately, away, but hopefully be back next week. Thanks for joining us.